is Hazel Khan. Thank you for tuning in to North Fork Works, where every month I introduce you to one of my interesting and energetic neighbours out here on the North Fork of the East End of Long Island. Today my guest is Gail Horton. For many people, her name is synonymous with the North Fork because she knows so much about its history. Welcome, Gail.
Very nice to be here, Hazel.
You were born in Greenport, and you told me you've never lived anywhere other than the North Fork.
I was born in a nor'easter, and that's how I got the name Gail. I'm from a Catholic family, and usually you get a saint's name, but I got the name Gail because I was born in a nor'easter. And I was born in Eastern Long Island Hospital, and it was a good childhood. I mean, I lost parents and a brother young, within 8 years, and that was tough, but the community is very supportive.
How old were you when your parents died?
I was 8 when my dad died, and then my brother was killed, my older brother, 4 years later, and then my mom when I was 15, almost 16.
So who looked after you?
My older sister, who's 10 years older than myself. She came down with her children and husband from Oneonta, where she'd gone to school and gotten married, and raised my younger brother and myself. I was the third of four children, and we lived on Horton's Lane in Southold, and my dad was the local veterinarian.
And at that time, you didn't know you were going to be marrying a Horton?
No, I didn't, and there's a funny story about when we went to get our marriage license. It was a great place to grow up because you could be quite free as kids, and the world watched out for you. Maybe sometimes you wish they weren't, because then they go tattle on you, but they did watch out and make sure that you were safe.
What would you have to be safe from in those days?
Well, maybe playing a dangerous game or just going far away from home and when you shouldn't have been and it's dark out, or doing something naughty.
Were your parents also from the North Fork?
My mother's family was. Her last name was Diamond, D-I-M-O-N. My maiden name was Fisher. Since my husband and I were related through about 16 local families.
Explain what that means.
Well, that means that in both of our lines, there were Youngs, there were maybe Tuttles, there were Albertsons, all throughout our line. So we were really related through many of those families.
How far does your family, can you trace them back?
The family can be traced back to Barnabas Horton from a daughter, Mary of Barnabas, who was one of the original settlers, white people, to settle out here. Those were 1640.
As white as opposed to Native Americans.
Correct.
What was their line of work? What were their lines of work?
Farmers, mostly. They say he was a baker, but I haven't seen that. You know, we have the Horton Barnabas Horton gun in our house. Did I tell you that?
No.
I didn't show you the gun. Yeah, it's like an old musket, I think, where you stuff the gunpowder in and tamp it down and then touch a match in a pipe and shoot that way. So it was passed down through my husband's family because he was a direct descendant.
And what about the house you're living in? Was that, you told me that you moved in there when you got married.
Right, that was my husband's grandfather and grandmother, Eva Albertson Horton, and her husband built it, Schuyler Bogart Horton.
So all of these names, people aren't called Barnabas or Schuyler sometimes, I think.
They're naming girls that now. But Bogart was a very beloved minister from the South Side, and Schuyler Bogart's mother came from Southampton, and Reverend Bogart was in the Presbyterian Church there.
Were there any shipbuilders or seafaring people in your family?
Well, Captain Diamond, who built the Jamesport Manor, who was like a great-great uncle, I wouldn't swear to the number of greats, but he was a sea captain. And the story was he married a Peruvian woman and she was dark-skinned, and he brought her back here and she was scorned, so he built this mansion for her, and they had two daughters, and that line has really died out. But John Diamond was a gentleman farmer, and he was a ship repair person.
So you have three children, is that right?
Correct.
Are they interested in North Fork history or family history?
My oldest son really is Daniel Barnabas Horton. He's very interested, and he writes about it. He's an excellent writer, and he knows a lot. And the other two are not as intensely interested, but they're interested in the history.
And they're passing it on to their children?
And they're passing it on to their children. Mm-hmm. And they named Justice Horton, my son, Josh's son, his name Justice, and that was and a great-great-grandfather. It's a Roman name from the 12 Apostles. I went away to the University of Tampa in Florida. I can remember flying there in a prop jet. And I just loved it because Southold rolled up the streets at 8 o'clock at night. I used to work in Kramer's drugstore. I can remember walking home and it'd be so quiet. And at that time, I was thrilled to be in Tampa, in just the outskirts of the downtown, where there was an Ayers Diner open all night. And we used to sneak out the fire escape and go to Ayers Diner and go. It was just wonderful to be in a urban place, a southern urban place. And then I finished my degree at Southampton College.
So then you came back home in essence. Why did you come back?
I don't know. You know, it's funny. I didn't want to come back. I mean, I really didn't want to live here. I think some of it was having lost parents young. I always felt people felt sorry for me, and I didn't like victimhood. So that was important to me to overcome that. But I met my husband, and we fell in love, and he was a funeral director, and he was a fourth-generation funeral director in the family, so we lived here. People are very tied to their funeral homes. I remember that with Dave. You know, they're very tied to with whom they bury, out here anyway. And I can remember we used to go out Sunday mornings for breakfast in the Coronet, and people would come up and make funeral arrangements with them. We'd be sitting there. It was never a peaceful breakfast.
They would come and make funeral arrangements. You mean somebody just died or just in case?
In case, you know, sort of like a casual pre-arrangement. Dave said it even happened to him in the IGA or AMP or whatever we had at the time. Really? He'd go downtown to shop and people would stop, oh, Dave, or Mother's Tomb isn't quite right, Tombstone, being a small town funeral director. You know, he had a strong sense of service.
And it was called Horton's Funeral Home. Mm-hmm. Now it isn't.
S.B. Horton's Funeral Home from Schuyler Bogart.
But it still is now called that?
Horton Matthey Funeral Home, it's called now. He still mm-hmm. uses our name.
You call yourself a chronicler rather than a historian. So I'd like you to maybe talk about all of that.
Well, I'm very interested in people, and I love to listen, and I love to hear stories. I was very fortunate. My husband was a wonderful storyteller. And I've been surrounded by people who told stories all my life. My grandmother, Diamond, Huldah Taft Diamond, she used to sit with my brother and I after the chores were done, my little brother, and we were little kids. And she would teach me how to do all the handwork that I do. So my grandmother spent a lot of time with Dan and I, and she would tell us stories about growing up here. It fascinated me because she was a teacher. She studied for 2 weeks. And then she went and taught school, and she talked about teaching kids. I would imagine that was the Spanish-American War, but people who would be there in uniforms. And I'd say, Grandma, how did you make them behave? Because she was a tiny little woman. And she'd say, she could be stern. And she'd say, well, I just stood there, and I said, well, you have to do what I said. And they did, she said. She was so cute. But she told us wonderful stories about growing up out here and what her life was like. And I guess that probably was my first introduction that I remember of enjoying stories. And I just have always been that way ever since.
Did you write them down or anything?
No, unfortunately I didn't. I don't, like my younger brother Dan Fisher has a wonderful memory and can remember them. I don't have the crystalline memory that he has, but I have another kind of memory that works for me, and then I find out things I'm missing.
So your memory of those stories, you write those, or you tell other people, you tell your children them? Yeah.
I tell my kids and people what my grandmother said about growing up out here, mm-hmm. yes.
You said your grandmother taught you handiwork.
I still crochet, like she taught me, and I also, Mrs. Terry, a neighbor across the street, who was also a young widow with 4 children, and we were very close with her. She would have us sit down, her 2 boys and myself, and she had a wonderful rag room. I loved that room. It was beautiful.
Rag room?
A room filled with rags and a sewing machine in the middle. And she'd let us run in and get rags and dress all up in them and run around the house and everything. But she would sit us down, and she was a thrifty woman from Texas who was raised poor. And so she taught us to crochet rugs out of the rags. We crocheted them and she sewed them together. She also taught me organic gardening too.
But did she call it organic gardening?
No, but gardening. But that's what it was, mm-hmm. now that I know right. what organic gardening is. But my grandmother did the same thing. And as she did those things, and rug cooking was one of them, quilting, piecing things together, sewing rags together to take them to the weavers at Halleckville, she would tell us stories. So it was very rhythmic. And it must have had a comforting impact on me, because that form of artwork still has, what particularly my rug, has a very comforting feeling, besides satisfying my desire to create artworks and use color and texture and form. It also is comforting to do.
When you talked about rhythms, the rhythm, was it, were you also talking as you were doing the work?
Yes.
So the story mm-hmm. telling or the conversation
right.
was part of.
Yeah, there's an Annie Proulx book, but she weaves into this book, it's about marine life, she weaves into this book stories of women getting together and rug hooking and the importance of that in their lives, getting together, they're making something functional for their homes, they're using rags, which is thrifty. They tell stories, but they'd also say what was going on in their lives. And it was a very meshed experience. Shipping News, that was the name yeah, of the book. Yeah. And she had two or three wonderful sections on describing these hooking circles.
So you mentioned Halleckville, and people listening to this program may not know what Halleckville is, but that kind of thing is still going on there.
Right. Well, they actually, I was the one that started the guild that's still going on there. They get together and help each other out, have visiting fiber artists come and sales and exhibitions and everything.
There are still shows and people get
exactly.
together and they...
The Peconic Ruggers meet there. And then they have the carving shop with Jack Coombs or maybe his son Michael. I don't know who's in there doing it. And I used to participate there with John Arlitson, who was a folk artist. And there'd be a woman who did tatting, myself, I did crocheting, somebody who did old-fashioned cooking, any of the traditional arts. I was a tradition bearer, and they were tradition bearers because we learned as children from an older person in our community, usually a grandparent or a parent. And we kept the tradition going. So it was a tradition bearers program, and school kids would come. And we'd sit and tell them stories, and they'd all crochet with us and work on things like that.
So tradition bearer, that's a formal designation of something?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Somebody who learned it traditionally. In other words, I didn't go to school for it. Mm-hmm. I learned it from my grandmother as a little girl.
So that's still being passed on then? You said when you've had school children come now, these
days?
Well,
I haven't done a program lately with them, but I like to do them. I like to just bring my work and sit and talk about it and show them and let them try. It's very satisfying to do. I've taught my little grandson, Justice, who is 7, and my granddaughter, Vera, who is 8, rudimentary hooking.
Gail Horton is talking about growing up on the North Fork and her work as historian, chronicler, writer, and artist. This is Hazel Kahn and North Fork Works on WPKN.
Why don't you talk about the hooking now? Because that is your main medium.
Right. I believe I told you before how I switched from being a painter to, when I had children, to rug hooking because it fit in with my life more and it was more social. So rug hooking, I do my own design. And I remember George Wells, who was a pretty prominent rug hooker. He had a studio in Glen Head and he made rugs for the Kennedys and the Rockefellers and everything. And he always said to me in the beginning, he was an early mentor, he said, Gail, do not lose your painterly style. So I've always designed my own rugs. Sometimes I've done commissions where people tell me what they want in it and I put them in there.
What's it, is it usually their own family history or is their own story?
It's usually it's a, I've done commissions for wedding rugs. Mm. I've done people's animals a lot. I do a lot of dogs and cats and horses. And
almost like portraits, I suppose.
It is. Mm-hmm. And my designs come from everywhere. And then I pick my fabrics. Sometimes they're old used clothes that I've washed up and cut apart. And
that was confusing when I saw your work first. I didn't realize that you use actual fabrics. Somehow I was thinking yarn. But in fact, you use both. And
right.
You make the fabric into yarn.
Yeah, about a quarter of an inch wide. Sometimes smaller if I need to do detail like a face or something. Mm-hmm. So I have the wool and everything's all color planned and I have it in a basket. I pick out a lot of a hue, several shades and variations, almost like painting to me, the way I try and mix the colors by
mixing the
strips, using a palette. And then I cut them. Yeah, I hand cut the strips. But I use wool fabric, I use wool yarn, and as you saw, I use metallics if the hanging's not on the floor. So I cut them in strips and then I hook my design.
Your pieces can be quite large.
Yeah, my largest, my story of the Irish mermaid, is 81 inches by 81.
So what is your fascination with mermaids?
They're a story of how people interpreted the world in early times. And the other fascination with mermaid is growing up here, I was at the beach all the time. We had bungalows that we rented out on the Sound, so I was always up on the Sound beach. Have you ever had, when you swim, like a pocket of air or water go by that feels very different? It's from a current. Well, somehow I got a notion that was mermaids when I was a little kid, and I've always been fascinated with them. And then Esther Williams came along, and I don't know whether it was because she was a mermaid or she had Fernando Llamas. I don't know about that. But anyway, I thought that was great. And I've always been fascinated. And I did the story of the Irish mermaid because that mythology was an interpretation of how they saw the world around them and how they answered the questions of what was going on. Like the mermaid figure was a way they answered the questions. Like if something happened to a sailor, well, maybe a siren. In Peru, there are mermaids in their churches, and these mermaids were used in their churches, not as a symbol of evil and temptation, as they are in the Irish churches, but they're used as a symbol of the virgin birth, because obviously she couldn't have sex, I would say.
Not the mermaids I've seen, that's for sure. So is there anything else you could say about being a chronicler rather than a historian?
Well, a chronicler is, although I do plenty of research and I try to get my facts correct, I work very hard at that and seek that. I think when you chronicle, you also tell the story of the time through, a lot of times through what people said about it or through what they tell you about it. I feel that people's vision of the time tell a lot of the time, too, other than the facts that you find in primary documents.
And then you're telling it
in print, right.
Okay, well, that's actually what I wanted to ask you about. I was surprised when you told me that all your work, or most of your work, is published in the Peconic Bay Shopper, which is a freebie.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked, I mean, there's some really wonderful things in there. And my first thought was, but it's a freebie. You give it away. And
I get paid.
Oh, you get paid for it.
Take me ages to write them.
Well, I know. I mean, I read some of them. It's an interesting way of distributing your work. Isn't it an unusual arrangement with a daily shopper?
Monthly, right.
Monthly produced here in Southold?
Well, the Hegemans love local history. They're really appreciators. They've been here. They will let me do what I want to do, write a story on. And I have people all the time giving me story ideas, and it's so much fun to go out and meet these people and put it into a story. I mean, one time I'm just thinking somebody came in from East Marion and bought all this information on the Picket Patrol, which was a Coast Guard effort using local boats and local people to go out in the Atlantic and look like a local boat and check for German submarines who were during World War II. So all of a sudden I was handed all these primary things and I could interview and look up and write a story about the Picket Patrol, which I truly enjoyed.
So if people do want to find some of your stories, is there a website?
It's the Peconic Bay Shopper, they are, but all my stories aren't there. They were published there, but they just started doing a website with them.
So you do one more or less every month?
I have been, but right now I'm working on a project for the Historical Society, and then I'm working, I don't know whether I told you, I'm working on a biography of Perry Duryea Jr., who was a lobster man and the state assembly leader. I was asked to do it, and I am fascinated with that period of Long Island history after the war.
After the Second World War?
Yeah, after Second World War, how it changed, how suburbs came in, and how we developed from a farming island to a suburb island, the Long Island Expressway, how it goes along with the Eisenhower Interstate. And I mean, that all fascinates me.
People feel very specially about Greenport, don't they? I mean, there's the North Fork and people feel it's a special place. Do you think, I mean, the Greenport is special even within the specialness of the North Fork?
Yeah. When you think about how we were settled, well, we were a whaling community. We were 17th in the United States in importance as a whaling community. And the population that it brought in and the fact that it brought sailors into town who'd been out on boats for a long time just created a wonderful mix of people. We had tremendous immigration from the world that boats brought into us. And then our different early industries like brickmaking, railroad, they brought in another collection of people that weren't especially infused in the rest of the North Fork.
I think I'd like to go from the past into the present and
sure.
the future. I want to get back to the 16 families. Are they the founding families? Are they called anything?
Well, yes, they are. I would say they were the Youngs, the Hortons, the Hallecks, all the very early founding families. Right.
So you think of these families as the founders?
I would say a lot of them were, right, mm-hmm. or mm-hmm. early. Founders are early, but they were the early establishment here.
I don't want it to sound like a sort of awkward question, but I would like to find out how people like you and other people go back as far as how they feel about people like me, and I'm obviously not being personal. Are those the people you tend to see? Are those your friends? Is it like a sort of a network that one doesn't see that's below the surface in some way?
Well, I would say that the people, I'll talk for Greenport, the people that move in there, because we have that little small village government, people integrate a lot. But I do think that when I think about parties and things like that, there's a separation there. Mm-hmm. But now my friends that I hang out with the most are, I guess you'd call them newcomers.
And you're connected through art things? Or
connected through art and the Historical Society and things like that. Mm. There are people who move in who love it there, you know, but they want to be part of it. They like, including we locals, who I think are a smaller number now. And then there are some who don't want to. And that's on both sides.
Explain that. You mean the outsiders don't want, the newcomers don't want to? They want to keep separate? The established people want to keep separate?
I would say there's a degree of that there, too.
What are they each saying about each other, would you think?
Well, okay, I know that a lot of people think that the newcomers want to come in and change the way things are. And I always say, well, how do you think the Native Americans felt? I mean, I always say that to myself, even when I cop that attitude, which I do once in a while, I have to say. And I have that sticker on there. Now I can't get it off my car. You know, I'm a native. I was born here.
Native, born here. Yeah.
And I put it on my car. Now I feel, I wonder if that hurts some of my friends' feelings, because I have some very close friends who are from the village and you know, so the Bronx. And my son-in-law, he's from Scarsdale.
So at Christmas time or something, the people who get invited to parties that you might get invited to, are there parties where it's only old-timers?
Well, I would say if you go to fire department functions, that's mostly old-timers, mm-hmm. mostly. And I know that from being on the village board, and I went to all of them as a trustee. It's a different thing if you move here and you have children in school. I think that's an entree into the community. It right. brings you closer together. Or the same thing with some of the artists. You're interested in the same thing. It's history or art. So you cross boundaries that way.
But the main complaint, let's call it, that old-timers, people who are born here, that they might have about the newcomers is that they want to change things.
Yeah, or they want to come in and boss us around. But I mean, I have to say, I once in a while, I get what I would call a bad attitude that I just mentioned. It's the same thing about tourists. Well, I'm a tourist too. I love to travel. I always try to respect and treat every place I am with respect and judge it for what it is. I guess that's the thing when someone moves in out here and wants to change everything, and I mean really change it.
What kind of thing?
Well, the way the houses are, the way this is, the way that's done, and but it has to carry a certain attitude with it, like the people that live here don't know what the hell they're doing.
The natives. When you think about the future, what is progress and what is unacceptable?
Well, progress is keeping young families here to nurture and be an engine, keep us moving and to bring vitality and new ideas, because I do like new ideas. Even though I'm an old-timer, I do like new ideas. I feel keeping the area workable for younger people is very important. Affordable housing, it's always been one of my issues.
Many people say there's not nearly enough of that.
No, there isn't. I mean, I worked in that field and there isn't. But it's a tough one because it's zoning and it's very complicated.
So you want the progress of new blood, but what is it that you want to keep?
It's a fragile land. I like to call them two flukes, the two forks, are fragile. We have to be careful what we do with the land. So I believe in cluster zoning, where the water, there's potable water, and there's a way to remove the waste and everything. I think that can happen. I think that we can have affordable housing, but we can also have the historic preservation that tell us who we are and what we've developed as. I think that's important too.
Is there something else, some other essence of the area or the region that you want to protect, that you see as fragile, not in the way the environment is, but, you know, just in the culture, I suppose?
Well, I think that the people that were here to pass, I think it's good to pass along. That's why I'm a chronicler, because I like to pass along the history and the ideas and the thought of people. And I think it's important to sustain the total environment of the area is to keep the people here or the people's children, because, of course, we're going to be your ancestors someday. And
so is there a particular way of life? Is there something about the way of life here?
Well, the way of life here is certainly less frenetic than, say, what my daughter and son-in-law life is in living in Brooklyn and commuting by subway into the city and having a nanny come take care of the children. And simpler here to live your life, to work if you're lucky enough to have a job near here, and to go home at night and enjoy your home. There is a simpler mode of life here. Living in Greenport, where I live, I can walk to the hospital, to the library, and the downtown to shop. So that's Greenport, or any of the hamlets, and I like that.
I just would like people to know that there is this place, but not that too many people come and see it.
I'm with you.
Thank you very much, Gail.
Enjoyed this, and I enjoyed examining some of those ideas about locals versus newcomers and...
Good, I was a little bit anxious that you might not want to talk about that.
I don't know whether I verbalized it well, but I was glad to think about it and speak about it. I think that's a crucial thing here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. It was fun.
You heard Greenport resident Gail Horton talking about her life and work on the North Fork of Long Island. North Fork Works can be heard on the first Wednesday of each month at 7:30 p.m. on WPKN 89.5 FM Bridgeport and streaming and archived on WPKN.org. North Fork Works is produced by Tony Ernst and is available as podcasts on hazelkahn.com.